Let's start. All right. Thank you, everybody, for coming. Thank you to Nana's for arranging this. This is a nice mid-Chanukah get-together here. Okay. So I have, over the years, I've wondered about this. What was so bad about what the Greeks did? I mean, there's normally two issues of consideration. There's normally goes in two directions, right? Number one is the direction that they prohibited all of these mitzvos, right? No longer are we as they say in the Hanukkah play, no Shabbos, no Bris Milah, no kosher food, no Jewish something else, Jewish names, right? Only play our Greek games, right? That was number one. That there was a persecution that took place. It wasn't just these things were not allowed. It was if you go ahead and do this, you will be executed, right? That's it, right? They're prohibited the Jewish religion from taking place, right? That is one approach. And then there is this other approach that sort of slides underneath it of, oh, and the Hellenism that they tried to impose upon us, so that had all sorts of ramifications as well. That was considered to be also a very difficult and terrible thing that was imposed upon us, and for some reason was going to really be a problem for the future of the Jewish people. So it's that second part that I wanted to look into, especially in lieu of some listening and thinking that I've been and reading that I've been doing recently. One is anybody here is a follower of the 1840 podcast. So you recently did a couple of weeks on the origins of halacha, meaning sort of what did halacha look like during the time of the second Beis Hamikdash and prior to it. And is it the same? Is it traceable? Is it sort of the same, kind of the same, or completely different than the way halacha looks today? That's sort of been the topic of that. And along the lines of that was this, what did Second Beis Hamikdash Judaism look like? And truth is, and the real scant sources that are available, meaning what did the Second Beis Hamikdash itself, what it looked like. I mean, we have this picture that we have from the Holy Land Hotel. That was only the way the Beis Hamikdash looked the last 70 years or so. A little more than that. About 90, 100 years or so. That's as much use as they got out of that really big building. What did it look like a couple hundred years before that? And just what did society in general look like, and what did halacha look like, and things like that. So, and there's not so much to find out. And that's where the Chanukah story takes place. So that's one thing that I was going to say, you know, one issue. And took a read here, Dr. Lawrence Schiffman's, a friend of mine's book here, as well as some others, where they sort of historically tried to work through what was going on during the period of the Chanukah story. And there was a lot going on here. There was, on one hand, there was an attack of the what they call the Syrian Greeks. Do we need Barbara? Is there space? Do we need a okay. So we normally associate the villain of the Chanukah story. Who's the villain of the Chanukah story?
Antiochus,
right? Antiochus is known as Antiochus the Fourth, and he is known as a Syrian Greek, right? So what does it mean, a Syrian Greek? And B, what did he want to do this? He didn't do this apparently to any other people, that he said, we're going to abolish your religion and we're going to make sure everything's done. He only did this to the Jewish people. Right? So why?
Where else were they?
Where else was he? So he was...
Sorry, Syria.
The other two-thirds,
yeah,
right?
Alexander and...
Yeah, my read historically, from what I've been able to gather, it's not so easy to put this together, is that there were two different battles going on that sort of merged together as what's going on here. There was the international... There was the international empire, Greek empire battle that was going on. Essentially what happened there was Alexander the Great came, I think, in 350 or so B.C. He took over the entire land. After he passed away, the land divided up into three sections. There was the Syrian section, the Greek section, and the Egyptian section. And the Egyptian and the Syrians, right, Egyptian Greeks and Syrian Greeks, were constantly going back and forth over Eretz Yisrael. They were fighting back and forth as to, and the Jewish people who were in Israel at the time, so they're stuck in the middle, right? They and in terms of who they you know, you form an allegiance with one, and then the other side wins, so then you're a whole bunch of trouble, right? So there was this sort of world affairs thing going on at the time. There was also an internal Jewish battle that was going on at the time. And what was that? So there was, right, we've heard about the Kohen Gadol being sold and the, right, that kind of thing. So that started right around this time as well. In order to curry favor with these kings, within the Beis HaMikdash world and the Kohen Gadols and that power within the Jewish people, they were constantly trying to accommodate these kings as well. And part of that fight was, and which led to then arguments amongst the Jewish people, meaning who should we be supporting? Should we be supporting the Egyptians? Should we be supporting the Assyrians? Should we be supporting, right, the Ptolemy versus the Seleucids, right? Which side should we go? So that A leads to friction. And then beyond that, there was a belief that part of what the Greeks overall were doing was trying to spread this Greek culture. And the Greek culture usually was coming from within the cities, much like the cities were considered the cultural centers. And the Jewish people are then saying, well, you know, Jerusalem is this cultural center. We should try to make it like all the other cultural centers, especially because they weren't completely in control of Jerusalem, right? So Jerusalem was partly Greek, partly them. Yeah. So let's try to accommodate them by trying to accommodate their beliefs. And part of that went back and forth even before the Hanukkah story. There was an attack back of the more zealous religious group to try to reclaim the Beis HaMikdash. They were pushed back upon by the non. In fact, it was probably these Hellenized Jews that encouraged the Greeks to impose these kinds of restrictions on the Jewish people. That's part of what's underlying. And part of what is fueling these persecutions is not just the Greeks imposing these persecutions on the Jewish people. It is the Jewish people imposing some of these persecutions on the Jewish people. There was the Beis HaMikdash, when the idols first came into the Beis HaMikdash, it was done with the bracha of some of the people that were in charge of the Beis HaMikdash at the time. Not necessarily realizing it was Avodah Zarah, maybe they said it's sort of the same thing, we're just sort of acknowledging the Greeks and things like that, right? And they slowly but surely were able to make their way in. Perhaps became then a little bit more extreme, and because of some of the international politics, Antiochus felt the need to A, conquer the land, and B, also then because there was, the way these emperors worked, anytime there was any type of fighting within their territories, so they had to sort of throw down the gauntlet and make sure that things were at peace. In this case, Antiochus took his side with the Hellenists, with the Hellenist Jews, and therefore and cut out the rest of the religious Jews and said, you guys are out, and we're going to stomp you guys out completely. Okay, so part of it. So in terms of understanding the Hanukkah story, Antiochus becomes the villain, but part of it was also the Hellenist culture itself was part of the villain, because that was part of what was encouraging, telling Antiochus, pick a side, you know, and Antiochus himself wasn't necessarily the biggest cultural Hellenist, right? It was just part of what was going on in the culture of that culture of the time to impose itself upon the Jewish people, and then the Maccabees got control, and they were able to fight back, reclaim the Beis HaMikdash, and that's what we're celebrating over Hanukkah. Okay, but what was appealing about this Hellenist culture? So that then raises the question, okay, what was this Hellenist culture? And then that gives a different thought into this mention of Yavan, this mention of Greece that we sort of have an ambiguous feeling about, right? So now we understand a little bit more about why there is this ambiguous feeling. Yeah, there maybe is a need for it. On the other hand, that was what led to the Jews being imposed upon and being stomped out, or attempting to being stomped out before the Hanukkah story. So just a few sources that are on this page. If you want to look, fine. If not, not. I mostly just wrote these out for myself and figured I would share them. But the Rav Hirsch has a very long, if any Rav Hirsch fans on Klimish, Rav Hirsch has a very long discussion of these psukim at the end of Parshas Noach. At the end of Parshas Noach, we have the story after the flood. Noach has his drink. Noach gets drunk, and he has the episode with his children where Kenan is considered the son of there's Yefes, there's Shame, and then there's Tom. Right. So Ham, he's considered bad, right? He's considered out. He's considered the father of Canaan. So he's going to be considered to be the slave. Yefes and Shem, they were the ones that protected Noach. Shem is where we come from, right? So the Pasuk tells us, Yafte Elokim Yefes, V'yishkom Ba'ali Shem, V'yikanan Eved Lama. That Hashem will bring glory to Yefes, or beauty to Yefes, V'yishkon, and that will reside in the tents of Shem, V'yichanan Eved Lama. And Chanan, which is from Cham, right? It's just Cham already had his bracha, so he couldn't, right? So he goes to the grandson, Canaan. So Canaan, he's going to be an Eved by them. So Canaan is out. Canaan sort of represents paganism in the world, and that is sort of, he's sort of out of the picture in terms of the future. But then we have this Yefes, this idea of Yefes within the Oel of Shame, within the tent of Shame. So there is supposed to be, it seems, some allowance of Yefes being able to come in. What's Yefes? So two psukim later, in the beginning of Pasuk Yud, when it spells out the children of Yefes, so one of those children is Yavan. And Yavan is sort of circled in by the Torah Shebaal Peh as being, aha, that's what we're talking about. That Yavan is going to somehow have a foothold in the tent of Shem, and not necessarily being a bad thing. I mean, that's part of the bracha that Noach gave. Like that's considered to be appropriate. So what are some of these examples? So on one side, we have an example of the Gemara Megillah Daf Tes. The Gemara tells us that there are Svarim, when Svarim are written, not necessarily the Torah itself, but other, Nach, Nevi'im, and Ksuvim, when those were written. So the Rabbi Shimon Gamliel said that they were permitted to be written in Greek. And the Gemara gives some more background, Rabbi Yochanan, what was used for Rabbi Shimon Gamliel, plus the Pasuk says, Yefes Elokim Yefes, based on this Pasuk, that there's Devarim Shel Yefes, Yubal Yishem, that words of Yefes, Rashi interprets it as the beauty of the language or the beauty of the characters will be considered to be in Ol Shein. They will be permitted to be in. So that's an example of them getting in. On the other hand, there's a mission at the end of Masechta Sota that says Bepulmos Tel Titus Shel Titus, during the period of Titus or immediately after Titus, Gazru Alataros Kalos V'Shelo Yilmad Adam Kalos. They prohibited. This is after the destruction of the Beis Hamikdash. They prohibited crowns for brides, which is why some Rabbanim are actually strict about like those headband tiaras that girls wear. So some Rabbanim say, no, that's a violation of this halacha. So whatever, that's for another time. But the second thing that they said is, v'shol yilmad adam es bino yevanis, not to teach your children Greek. So on one hand, we have pro-Greek in Megillah, we have anti-Greek in Sota. Then we have a Gemara in Maseches Menachos that says that they asked Rabbi Shmuel, ben Dama, then Achososh Rabbi Shmuel asked his uncle Rabbi Shmuel, I've learned the entire Torah, which is a pretty cool thing to be able to say. But Kagon Ani Shalamati Kol Torah Kula Mahu Lalemed Lilmod Chachmas Yevanis. Am I allowed to learn Greek wisdom? Now again, Greek wisdom is not necessarily the same as Greek language, but am I allowed to learn Greek wisdom? So Karalev HaMikra Zeh, so he quoted this Pasuk, Lo Yamush Sefer Torah Zeh Mipicha V'Higisa Bo Yomam V'Layla. Torah should not leave your mouth, you should study it day and night. Say ubaduk sha she'ena lomin hayom v'lomin alayla. Find a time when it's not day and it's not night. V'lamud ba chachas yevanis, and that's the time you're allowed to learn Greek, right? So that has become the figure of speech adayom hazeh, right? Adayom hazeh, people will talk
at
like
dusk,
that. People say that.
Rambam,
oh yeah, find me a you know.
At dusk. Oh, Rambam would study these texts when he was in the bathroom.
Okay.
That's
a pshat.
That's a place
okay.
Where the sun doesn't shine.
Okay. Thank you, Dan. Okay. Very good.
But that's not necessarily day between day and night, but nonetheless.
Yeah.
It's the same idea.
You can't study Torah.
So, and we'll go just with one more statement along these lines, and that is a Medrash in Medrash Rabbah, B'choshech, and this is, by the way, this is right in the beginning, Parshas Beis and Bereishis Rabbah. This is on the Pasuk of B'choshech Apnei Tahom. On that word, Choshech, darkness that was across the expanse. So there the Medrash makes a comment. Choshech is referring to Galus Yavan, the exile of Yavan, Shehachshicha Einehem Shel Yisrael B'gzirosehem, that they darkened the eyes of Bnei Yisrael with their gzeiros, with their rules, because they told them, and this is a theme of Hanukkah out there, this ox's horn, Kisvu al Keren Hashur She'en Lachem Chelek Elokei Yisrael, right on the horn, on an ox horn, that you do not have a portion in the God of Israel. very ambiguous statement. Probably needs its own lunch and learn at some point. All the stuff having to do surrounding that. But we have sort of almost four. Right, we have the contradictory statements here. We're pro the language. On the other hand, we're anti learning, teaching your children. We're also anti the wisdom. And we have this line here in the Medrash saying that during that time that we Karen Shor, right, that this led to people saying she'ein lechem chelek, that you don't have a portion with the God of Israel.
The darkness part of
yeah,
it
and
is,
dark. Right, we're saying it's dark. So dark is generally not a good term, right? Michael, right, in the world of imagery, right? We could ask what's his name, the guy in the Dan Brown novels, right? The symbiology professor, Robert Langdon. Thank you. Right, we could ask Robert Langdon. I'm sure he would say dark is generally a symbol of bad. All right, I'm not sure, but I don't want to put words in his mouth, but I would assume that that's what he would say. So how do we reconcile this? Are we pro? Are we con? Where does it stand? So the answer probably lays, and many touch on this. I wasn't able to find like a source that said it like completely in this way. But I think when we talk about the Greek language, actually, the way I heard it best was a couple of years ago. Rabbi Meir Soloveitchik came and spoke down here, and he spoke specifically about that Gemara Menachos, about Bizman She'en Yom Ve'en Laila. And he suggested that what does it mean, Bizman She'en Yom Ve'en Laila? That means that the period where people do not, where we don't have an answer, right? What does it mean? When does day end and when does night begin? So, well, we're stuck every week. We have this question, right? Was candle lighting for some reason is 70 minutes before, or whatever it is, 60 minutes, 70 minutes, whatever we decide, right, before the end of Shabbos, right? So why is that? If it's one day, it should be 24 hours. So what's going on there? So the answer is that period of day to night is a period that we're just, that there is ambiguity about, that we're not certain about. And perhaps what Greek culture represented was the idea of philosophy, the idea that knowledge is something that we're able to attain, and it's something that we're able to be sure about. That science is something that we're able to be sure about. It's something that we're able to learn and then master, and then we get it all. And then we're able to move on and conquer more and conquer more and conquer more without a recognition that perhaps there's just something that I'm not quite understanding. There's something that I'm not quite getting, that there is sort of this space out there that is not just necessarily part of exactly what I understand. So they represent, it represents the idea of knowledge and beauty, and perhaps even idea of perfection or ideal of perfection, which we say that's very interesting, it's very nice, but that's not where we're at. We're a people that we thrive on the idea of dialectic, thrive on the idea that there's sort of a space that we're not exactly sure how to fit, where we thrive on the idea that people are created differently from one another, and what works in one area, you know, what works in one path of Avodas Hashem for one person is not necessarily going to be the same for another person. We work in that space of not necessarily being exact. And perhaps the most clear example of that is this last example, this Medrash, right? What did they write on this Karen Hashor, and why Karen Hashor? There's many explanations for what that is that I came across, which none really grabbed me, but the term, Ein Lachem Chelek Belukei Yisrael, you don't have a portion of God. What is that? What is our portion of God? What do we understand as being our portion of God? Our portion of God is our soul, right? Our soul, our neshama. How exactly do we understand our relationship with Hashem, that we are chilek elokai mimal, that we have a portion of Hashem? What does that mean? So it's not something that we're going to be able to say exactly. It's not something that we could define. By definition, it's not something that we're able to define. And therefore, we are able to be comfortable and say, you know, we try the best we can, we learn the most that we can, we do as many mitzvahs as we can, but ultimately we're not going to be able to achieve that perfection. And Rav Soloveitchik suggested that was the explanation of this Gemara, meaning you can learn Greek wisdom, but come from a place of recognizing that there is a zman, that there is a period that is not day and that is not night. Come from a place of humility. Come from a place of saying that I'm not going to be able to understand everything. I'm not going to be able to get it, and that's going to be okay. Then you'll be able to learn a little bit as to what they had to say. Very quickly, there is a halacha here that is in Shulchan Aruch in the middle of Yerodeya, where it talks about the prohibitions of superstition. And the Shulchan Aruch, for some reason, quotes the Rambam straight up, which is interesting, la'alacha, why he's doing that. But he talks about these healings. He says, he quotes the Rambam as saying that if you get bit by a snake or by a scorpion, you're allowed to do certain incantations, you're allowed to do certain things to heal you, even on Shabbos, even though it seems like that doesn't work medically. But that was a belief. People had these beliefs at the time. In fact, in Hilchos Shabbos, they're talking about creating these cameos, these amulets, thank you, because we can't necessarily understand it, but like it will make people feel better, so then maybe it will be okay. So there's different Rishonim understand it differently. Some say you can make them because they work, and some understand it as being you can make them because people think they work. And, you know, we're not going to get into big philosophical fights with them. They're in pain right now. Just let them be, and it will heal them. So the Rambam was a rationalist on the side of saying, even though these things are meaningless, they don't do anything, but you could do them anyways. That was the way he understood those Gemaras. So the Be'er Hagra, the Gra gets very upset with the Rambam, and he says, what do you mean? And, you know, it's pretty impressive 800 years later to get fight at the Rambam with these kinds of words. But he says, right, Aval Kol Habayim Acharav Chelkol, he says, everybody that came after the Rambam disagreed with him. Shrei Arbe Lachashim Nemru B'Gemara V'Hu Nimshach Achar Philosophia Harura. He says, because we followed the Gemara, and he was following the philosophers. V'lachein Kasav Shekshafim V'Shemos V'Lachshim V'Shedim V'Kamiyos Hakol Hu Sheker Aval Kvar Hiku Son Al Kedkado Sharu Matzino Harbe. He says, it's true. He might think that they were that it was all false, but we already see many proofs that it works. And the Vilna Gaon was adamant against the Rambam on this line. I remember him quoting putting the word Aristotle in himself. I couldn't find that. Maybe it was the wrong edition. I couldn't find it. Maybe it's a different Be'er Hagra. No, the Be'er Hagra, I think Be'er Hagra, I believe himself, quoted Aris. He said, that's what the Rambam put into Aristotle. And that could be a different Be'er Hagra. I'm probably confusing it with a different one, because he...
So they believe the amulets actually did work.
So he believed...
Or the placebo.
I'm not sure he got it right or not, but he said, don't be so certain it doesn't. I think that was the way the Be'er Hagra was saying it. But don't be so sure. Maybe he had a little bit of humility. Now, the Rambam said that they don't, and the Gra was against them, right? Now, did the Rambam mean the apple? What exactly did the Rambam? The Rambam was at the edge of rationality, meaning I wouldn't accuse the Rambam of being Greek, although I guess that's what the Gra did, right? He accused him of being totally in that world, of being too much.
Yeah, in his time,
right?
A lot of his stuff got pushed back.
And Greek word philosophy.
Yes, right.
And
there you go.
He explicitly says that. You shouldn't read this Greek stuff, but I'm at a high level, I will get bad ideas. I'm going to read this, I'm going to distill out the stuff that's actually useful to you, and you read the Mishnah Torah, you don't have to read the Greek text.
Ah, okay.
That might be based on it.
Okay, right. All right, maybe. So, but you see this argument going on. I mean, I don't think the Gra was on the wrong side of the Hanukkah story. The Rambam was on the wrong side of the Hanukkah story. I'm not going there. But I think what the Vilna Gaon is trying to bring out for us is like have some humility. You might these things might not you might not understand. You might not get it. You might whatever. But like you'll be okay with it. I remember when I was in. Before I was in yeshiva, somebody who had just gotten back from a more rational yeshiva. I remember him arguing with me about something, I don't remember what it was. I think it had to do actually with food or something like that. I don't remember what it was. But something about these lines. He said to me, why would you want to hold like the Ramban, who is of course more mystical, right? The Rambam is like more rational. You can understand that. I remember saying to him, I don't know, I'm 17 years old. Why do I have to think I have to understand everything? Like, I'm okay. Like, you know, I'll leave it as something that maybe I'll get to at some point later on. Going back to our original question, what was so bad about the Greeks anyways? So the Greek monarchy imposing, right, so that's one area of Hanukkah. But in terms of the philosophy, that was perhaps what caused a lot of this in the first place, historically, just the historical arguments amongst the Jewish people. Should we accept it, not accept it, accept it more, accept it less, right? So that So that was probably, if you would distill that into one term, it would be this idea of certitude, meaning that we are not going to be certain. We're not going to say absolutely that's the way it is, right? We leave things open and say, maybe I don't understand, but I'm still going to continue with emunah. I'm still going to continue with faith either way.
That's all about the assimilation. And yeah. That was their style.
Yeah. Right. Right. And you throw in the miracle of the menorah, right? The miracle of the menorah was, we're going to put it up, even though I don't necessarily know what's going to happen, right? The candle, right? You put this candle, that candle's not going to last, that's going to last one day, right? We're certain that it's going to last one day. All right. Sometimes it lasts a little bit longer. However you're going to work it out, sometimes it's going to work out. So we do what we can, try to understand as much as we can, we grow as much as we can, doing mitzvahs as we can, and then we're able to say to Hashem, okay, I did the best that we can, and hopefully you'll fill in the rest for us. Okay, so thank you everybody for coming, and you can thank Gladys next time you see her as well. Chag Sameach.